Now that I have created quorum. Good morning. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Education, for Wednesday, April 5th, 2017. And while we're at it, open a hearing on Senate Bill 5524, the Higher Education Coordinating Committee Budget Bill. And according to my sheet, once again, we will be hearing from Ben Cannon, Executive Director, and today, and again, Patrick Crane, the Director of the Office for Community Colleges and Workforce Development.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I'm flanked by two Patricks, our budget analyst.
A rare privilege.
From DAS as well. Before we get started, and this will really be Patrick Crane's presentation today on the community college funding, but I do want to draw your attention to the letter that we provided in response to the questions that arose on Monday. And there's a lot in here. Let me flag a couple of things that may be of particular interest. In response to a question from Representative Smith Warner about trends of transfer students, which have generally been up, we noted that that is essentially consistent with the overall FTE enrollment trends that our community colleges and universities have experienced. In response to the question, Representative Lively asked about the intent of students. We've provided some additional information based on national survey data. We do not, as we noted on Monday, we don't have that sort of locked in for Oregon Community College students specifically, but there's some, I think, useful background information here about the intent of community college students generally, according to some national survey data.
Your office.
In response to a question from Senator Roblin about credit loss, we reemphasized the degree to which this does occur as community college students transfer to four-year universities, and we've used our data to estimate the approximate credit loss that our community college students today experience in that process. And again, this was a topic of considerable interest to this committee, and we appreciate that in part because it is certainly possible that we'll be talking to you about a policy bill related to that if it heads this way from the House Higher Ed and Workforce Committee. Some additional questions about transfer, and I was very pleased to note, and I'll probably use this to introduce Patrick Crane, but Representative Wisnett asked about the European process of aligning credit, and it turned out we had an expert on staff, Patrick Crane, who you'll hear from in a moment in the course of his PhD work, did a dissertation on the Bologna process.
We've
drawn from him and the years that he spent in Europe studying the that among other higher education topics to draw some highlights. So we're here to serve, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, and with that, I'll turn it over to our Director of the Office of Community College and Workforce Development at the HEC, Patrick Crane.
Great, thank you, Ben. So good morning, Co-Chair Smith, Mortimer, Monroe, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Patrick Crane. I'm the Director of HEC's Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. This morning kicks off the first of 3 days focused on community colleges. Today we'll be hearing from primarily me from the state perspective. Tomorrow will be led by the Oregon Community College Association, and then public comment next Monday. Our budget priorities remain the same, focused primarily on student success, completion, helping the state of Oregon to achieve 40-40-20, and looking at the ways that public support and public institutions can help students achieve their goals. You've seen this before as well. The key performance metrics themselves will be discussed on the last day. They'll appear in appendix to all of these materials. But just looking through them, you can see that 15 of our key performance metrics do relate directly to community colleges and community college students. Moving into an overview of what I'll talk about today, I'll really focus on four main topics looking at community colleges in Oregon. The first topic will be structure and governance, looking particularly at areas where HEC has responsibility, where community colleges have responsibility, and where we have shared responsibility for issues around student success and student completion in the state. Second, we'll look at student enrollment and outcomes. This primarily draws on data that we have in-house in our Office of Research and Data. Some of it will be historical, some of it will be snapshot data, just to provide a better context about who community college students are in Oregon, what they look like, and some of the challenges they face. Community college funding will be the third topic. This will look primarily at state funding historically, but also look at the additional revenue streams that provide funding for community colleges, local property taxes, tuition, and I'll touch briefly on some of the federal funding, primarily the Pell Grant as well. Finally, I'll walk through the mechanics of the Community College Support Fund and provide some preliminary information about what does this money do? How do colleges actually spend the funding that they receive? So there are 17 community colleges in Oregon with 60 satellite campuses throughout the state. You can see here on this map where the colleges are located and the districts they serve. Areas in white on the map are areas where counties or municipalities that do not pay property taxes to provide community colleges. Many of those are served by contracts out of district where community colleges choose to provide services for a fee to areas that do not have community colleges of their own. It's important to note that each of the 17 community colleges are governed by a locally elected board. They're not a system, but they voluntarily coordinate with one another through advocacy and affinity groups, including the Community College Association, Oregon President's Council, Council of Student Service Administrators, the Oregon Community College Council of Institutional Researchers. Each of these groups meets at least quarterly, and HEC staff participate in all of these meetings. We generally have a standing agenda item to provide updates from the state, answer questions, talk through anything that's of relevance and mutual interest to us and to them, and work through any issues that arise. Looking at the bottom of the slide, these are some of the areas where over the last several years there have been particularly strong shared interest in activities and coordinated activities. Some of these I spoke to in the pathways presentation, particularly developmental education and career pathways. You'll hear more about guided pathways tomorrow. I believe Greg Heyman, president of Lynn Benton Community College, will speak about that and the role that their college is playing in a national consortium to expand guided pathways. Data collection and research. This is something that has been of strong interest to the colleges and strong interest to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So prior to my role as the community college director, I was the research director. And yes, sir.
Yeah, Patrick, do the 17 community colleges generally have the same curriculum across the board, or do some of the community colleges have specialties more in, especially in technical or more expensive offerings? And if so, how about the funding, the way we fund community colleges from the state, and do we take into consideration the cost of some programs versus others, some specialties versus others? For example, we know it costs more to educate a person with a medical field, nursing or something like that, than for some other fields. That's an issue that I'm very interested in because I'm questioning, I guess, the way we fund community colleges just blanket by FTE rather than taking into consideration the kind of training that we're providing and the jobs that those students will be able to get because of that training.
Co-Chair Monroe, Smith Warner, I think there's two answers to your question. First, I think the majority of courses are relatively similar across institutions, but you're absolutely correct that there are specialty programs that exist across the 17 community colleges, particularly in the areas of career and technical education, designed to meet specific workforce needs. To your question of how colleges are funded, I'll go into some detail at the end of the presentation, but the answer is that we do not differentiate between the types of credits and do not provide differential funding for different types of programs. There's essentially a flat reimbursement rate for courses that are taught, with the exception of hobby and recreation courses, which we do not reimburse.
Follow up? And should there be differentiation?
I think that is an excellent question, and one that the community colleges would be interested in discussing. I'm not sure that there is consensus around the best way to do that, but it's certainly a topic of interest.
Well, Madam Co-Chair, I'm concerned about this because I see in some offerings, I see vacant placements where they have to turn students away, students that want these quality technical kinds of training that lead to family wage jobs, and yet they're being turned away because those programs are more expensive, which makes me believe that maybe the way we're funding currently needs to be looked at.
Yes. Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, I think you're right, and President Mitsui from Portland Community College spoke to that a little bit yesterday. Technical programs are often higher cost programs. You need expensive equipment. The faculty members who are teaching those courses often have to be paid higher wages because they have the opportunity to work in the private sector as well. So those drive up costs. When funding levels go down, those can be programs that get cut first because of the higher cost per FTE, or at least it makes it very difficult to expand those programs to meet local workforce needs.
I know.
While not exhaustive, I did want to provide some general information about community college roles versus HEC roles and some of the ways that we work together. Community colleges are focused on open access. It's core to their mission. It's core to their values. Open access and I think workforce development are really the sort of twin pillars that community colleges focus their activities on. And in terms of meeting state goals, they're the primary driver for meeting the middle 40. They're not the exclusive driver of the middle 40. We have apprenticeship programs, industry recognized credentials, et cetera, but they are doing the bulk of the production of middle 40 degrees and credentials. As already mentioned, they work closely with local businesses to deliver customized workforce training. In addition to delivering customized workforce training, CTE programs have advisory councils made up of local employers that provide feedback on curriculum, assist with job placement, et cetera. The HECS role, and one of the ways, or several of the ways that we engage with them, we disperse the Community College Support Fund. And as Co-Chair Monroe mentioned, there are different ways that can be done, but it is a responsibility of the HEC to disperse the Community College Support Fund. A second responsibility for the HEC is providing technical assistance and approving programs in the career and technical education area. We also award funding and oversee adult basic education. This was referred to during the Pathways presentation, Title II under the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act. The Office of Community College and Workforce Development receives those funds and then competes the grants and disperses them out. We coordinate statewide programs, again, where there is mutual interest. Developmental education redesign would be one example. Career Pathway is another. And we collect and report student level data. So I'll spend a little time talking through this slide because I think it helps frame what the different community college missions are and the different ways that they provide services to Oregonians. What this does is look at the FTE of students and courses taught throughout the 17 community colleges in Oregon. And what you can see here is that approximately 15%, combining the adult basic skills and developmental education, of their activities are focused on preparing students for college level work. 25% of the FDE enrollment is focused on career and technical education, and just over half is focused on lower division coursework. economics, German, writing 121. So these courses not only provide a foundation for students in social sciences and humanities majors, but they also round out the general education requirements for students in career and technical education programs. About 6% of the courses are non-reimbursable. These are hobby courses, which are defined as directed activity engaged in by individuals as an avocation, resulting in a collection of objects or in the production of work. So photography classes, for example, or painting classes would not be reimbursed by the state. So I think this is, again, an important picture to look at the variety of activities that community colleges undertake and the different types of courses that they deliver to provide training and education for Oregonians.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Director Camp Crane, how stable is this breakup of percentages over a long? Because, I mean, that's you know, I always bragging about our community colleges. They can respond to community needs easily. And so I would assume this is not a stable percentage breakout, is it?
I can provide you with specific information on that. When I looked at this historically, it's relatively stable. I think the portion of career and technical education fluctuates the most, again, related to the amount of funding available.
Follow up real quick.
Go ahead.
The non-reimbursement, is that very much?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, 6% approximately of the activities across the 17 community colleges are non-reimbursable.
Quick follow-up. So in my district, you know, so many retired people, I think there's a lot of interest in those special non-reimbursement courses.
Yes. And
certain geographic areas in that population areas, that may be the.
Yes. Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, I believe your area, Central Oregon, as well as the coast, both have large percentages of non-reimbursable FTE.
Thank you.
And as, yes.
Either way.
As Senator Roblin always says, we used to emphasize more those kinds of activities that are kind of for hobbies or for whatever, and we think there might have been a relationship between the level of support for our community colleges and the amount of those kinds of programs.
And
Senator Roblin.
And not only that, because they are not the most expensive courses, they brought in resources which were allowed to be spent on things like nursing programs and other things so that it balances out, so that you could afford some of the more expensive vocational programs because the reimbursement gave you money to both have the course and put money into those things which you could meet the immediate needs of your communities. So I've always wished we could go back to the days when we...
The good old days.
And I know that that would be true of Central Oregon, and it may be different for other parts of the state, but I agree with you that on the coast and in Central Oregon, where we have a older population, there tends to be a real connection between community colleges and their retirement communities. So thanks.
So from here, we'll look at some of the demographic data on student enrollment as well as completions across Oregon's 17 community colleges. I think it's important to note that the traditional notion of a student that graduates from high school and enrolls directly in a four-year residential college is no longer the majority of students writ large in the United States, and certainly in the community college sector, that is not the case. In looking at an age breakdown of students, the largest portion our early career, 22 to 34-year-olds who are enrolling in community college, maybe took a break between high school and pursuing post-secondary education, came, pursued post-secondary education, left, realized they needed additional training, came back, and re-entered. Looking at some of the traditional and high school age students, again, the high school students, you can see, we spoke about this a couple days ago, dual credit courses are approximately 12% of the students at community colleges, but the age range really is quite large with a focus on early career individuals. And this slide looks at the percentage of full-time to part-time students. And I was quite surprised myself in looking at this because we don't generally think of full-time and part-time as being this far apart, particularly within community college, but in higher education in general. And after spending considerable time working with our research office and looking a little bit deeper into this, I think there are a couple things to note here. First, the way full-time is defined within the community college data system is 510 clock hours per year. And I spent some time yesterday trying to figure out why we have 510 clock hours as the number. And what it breaks down to is three quarters, one of 12 weeks, two of 11 weeks, which is 34 weeks of instruction at 15 hours of instruction per week. So it's not the only definition used cross-country, but that is the definition in Oregon. So looking at that,
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Crane, how do are your contracts negotiated, by days or hours for your professors? Or, do you know?
I don't know.
Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Please.
In our K-12 program, we always talk about school days,
mm-hmm.
but it's really negotiations, I understand, is hours. We never talk about that. It's I think to whichever is to our advantage, we talk about days or hours. But so you do it. You've got the same, but you're focusing on hours.
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett. I don't know how the local contracts are negotiated between the boards and their staff. I think it varies somewhat depending on the institution. But you're right, we're talking about hours here. And as I understand it, the rationale for that was because there are non-credit courses, programs developed to meet local workforce needs that aren't necessarily generating academic credit, so it was necessary to come up with a clock hour definition in order to capture that work that was being done by the community colleges.
Just a comment.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is that a concern? Is that something we need to look at or address, how we do the let's face it, everyone in this room and everyone in this building knows that our cost is employee. So mm-hmm. is that I get a lot of requests from school boards and school board members to the state should be helping statewide negotiations so we don't have to face our neighbors and things at the negotiations and get this more stable. But just a comment. No response necessary. Thank you.
Go ahead. Great.
Thank you. One other item that I'll point to on this slide is looking at the average credit load per term. After reviewing all of the courses taught in 2014-15, what became clear is that the average student is taking 5.8 credits per term. Full-time is 15 credits, as calculated for tuition and fee purposes in the community college system. So the majority of students are taking less than half time, which is, I think, one of the driving factors for both low completion rates and long time to completion, mm-hmm. Which I'll touch on a little bit later. And just sort of more curious than anything else was the declining credit load over the quarters, that students take more credits, 6.1 on average in the fall, or 6.2, excuse me, and it declines over the year. We know from the research literature that first-year retention is a big issue for both community college and universities, and really just first-term to second-term retention is a period where students are often lost, which I imagine is a factor in this.
Representative Lively.
Madam Co-Chair, so I do find this contrary to what I would have believed, but I'm trying to understand when we go back to the hours, the calculation of hours, so for students enrolled in the tech courses, in many cases, they enroll in the course with an outcome not necessarily being a degree, but the skills in that mm-hmm. versus the others. I'm trying to understand how the hours, when you're talking about the kind of the average load, how the average load in those courses may compare to the average load of those taking college transfer courses. I mean, that's where I'm getting confused with regarding how you view these students, because many of those students are in a career path to reach at a certain point on a certain time, but I don't know if the hours are calculated the same or if there's no comparison.
Co-chairs, Representative Lively, the hours are calculated the same. I don't know if the enrollment intensity is greater in career and technical education courses. For example, if those students are taking 40 hours a week of coursework versus 10. But I think many of them would still fall into the part-time category, because if they're coming for just two quarters, even if they're enrolling full-time, they won't necessarily meet the full-time threshold.
Thank you. And before you go off this, just because you made the mistake of mentioning that you used to be the research director, I would be interested if it's a doable thing to kind of see the range across the schools of the full-time and part-time. And it'd be interesting to see if there's, you know, does Mount Hood have a lot more full-times, or PCC has a lot more than, you know, and kind of see how it ranges in the splits between full and part-time.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, you're in luck. We have already run that. the researcher who did that is in the audience, and so we can very easily provide that to you.
Great. Thank you. Senator Roblin.
I think one of the things we have to be really careful about in this conversation is what the term hours means, because there's credit hours, there's seat time hours, there's a lot of different hours. And then you go to K-12, and it's based on hours, and that's actually hours that the school is in session and that courses are being provided. Each one of those we use in a different way at times, and it can be very confusing when we have these kinds of conversations. And it would also be nice to see connected to that what the percentage of part-time staff is in community colleges in comparison to percentage of part-time students, because that creates issues that are different as well, and we continue to have conversations in our policy committees about, you know, how do they get employment, how do they get insurance, all of those kinds of things. And I think community colleges have done a really great job of trying to meet the needs that we've told them that they have to do in sometimes very creative ways. But a part-time student in a vocational track oftentimes is in school a lot more hours, because the credit attributed to that class includes labs, which take a lot more time, and you don't get a lot of credit for them. So it's interesting how all of that works together. And it's a pretty complex system.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
And when I was teaching in college anyway, a 12-hour load was considered a full-time load for a professor. If you were teaching 12 credit hours, that
credit
was full-time.
Hours, yep.
But for students, it's always been 15 hours is considered full-time. Anyway.
Yep.
This slide looks, this presents a side-by-side comparison of race ethnicity across K-12 students, Oregon adults, and the community college system, or the community college institutions. So this is an attempt to describe demographically the students in Oregon's community colleges and provide some relevant comparison, both looking at census data for race ethnicity across Oregon and the K-12 system. You can see with the K-12 bar that there is a growing Hispanic population in the secondary school system that is different from the way the adult Oregonian population is broken down. The community college system is somewhere in between. It's closer, it's a little more reflective of the overall adult population in Oregon, but there's growing diversity. I will note that we have a fairly large not reported percent, about 20% of the data, and that is for a variety of reasons. Students are not required to report race ethnicity data, and particularly students who are taking a course or maybe receiving a customized training program or hobby course, we're unlikely to have that information from them. In pulling out the not reported data, the proportions, particularly of Hispanic students and multi-ethnic students, do exceed those of the population of the state of Oregon as a whole.
Madam Co-Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Is that at least partly because some of them are undocumented?
Co-Chair Monroe, Smith-Warner, it I can't say for certain, but I think it is probable that some students are not providing social security numbers, race, they're holding back personally identifiable information because they may have concerns about how that data may be used.
Thank you.
This slide provides a historical look, and again, I think I mentioned this already, but it's important to note that the Hispanic-Latino population is growing both in Oregon and in Oregon's community colleges, and the multi-ethnic population is growing across the 17 institutions.
Co-chair.
Co-chair Monroe.
Do we know which community colleges tend to have the higher percentage of Latino?
We do have that information available, okay. And we can provide that.
I'd love to see it.
This slide looks at completions. We'll go through a couple more that break down completions in a couple different ways. This number you've seen before, but 21,647 certificates and degrees were awarded in Oregon community colleges in 2016. Transfer is also a function that community colleges serve, and this looks at the increase in transfer students over time. It's important to note that we can't add these numbers together. Many students complete a certificate degree and then transfer. There was an OUS study from 2009-10 that identified 72% of community college student transfers do not complete a certificate or degree before enrolling in a university. I imagine that that number is, or that percentage is lower now. There's been a big uptick in certificate production within Oregon's community colleges, which you'll see in the next slide. So I would estimate that there are more students enrolling in universities having completed a certificate degree at a community college, but we don't have an updated study to prove that information. This slide shows the increase in certificate and degree production, and you can see it's a fairly steep curve upwards in degree production, particularly in the certificate area. So I think some of that has to do with the Oregon transfer modules are counted in here. There was a reverse transfer initiative to make sure students were awarded certificates and degrees for credits earned several years back. So I think those are factors as well.
And the transfer modules, are those counted under certificates or under degrees?
Certificates.
Okay, thank you.
And again, trying to look at certificate and degree production in community colleges through the equity lens, this breaks down completions by race, ethnicity. And what we can see is that the percentage of Hispanic students completing also increases. And so it's important to note, this is not a longitudinal snapshot. We did not follow one cohort of students through 10 years. These are discrete periods of time. But I think as the percentage of Hispanic and multi-ethnic students has increased in the community colleges, so has the proportion of completers. This is data from the federal IPEDS data system, Integrated Post-Secondary Education data set. And this is a three-year graduation rate for community colleges. It's important to provide a couple key caveats to this data. First, it's a federal calculation to use 150% of anticipated time to degree for completion. So that means 3 years for community college associate's degrees, 6 years for bachelor's degree. It's even more important to note that this only looks at first-time, full-time degree-seeking students. So thinking back to the slide on full-time versus part-time enrollment and enrollment intensity, this graduation rate does not reflect the entire population of community college students. In recognition of that, the American Association of Community Colleges has been working for the last several years on something called the Voluntary Framework of Accountability. It's essentially a new way of collecting and calculating enrollment and completion rates for community colleges. Over 100 institutions nationwide have been using this. Oregon this year will be one of just a few states that are going statewide. So that data will be reported in August. So we should be able to provide that this fall. And that will look a little more accurately at student enrollment intensity and to try and discern a little bit more about intent, which we know is difficult to capture.
Is that slight increase statistically significant at all, or does that just basically track with increased enrollment? And I don't know if you know that off the top of your head.
I do not know the answer to that, okay. Co-Chair Smith-Warner.
I mean, it doesn't look terribly significantly, but I know that that's not always the best determinant.
I would be very hesitant to give a definitive answer.
Okay, thank you.
Moving into community college funding in Oregon, I'll walk through, again, state funding, a little bit about tuition, some historical look at this, as well as look briefly at federal funding through the Pell Grant program. So looking at community college funding over time, you can see that there have been significant fluctuations in funding and enrollment, and you'll note that particularly in 2010-11, the two diverged in a way that was very challenging for community colleges. This is a trend nationally. When there is a recession, when the economy is bad, people return to post-secondary education to receive additional training and to, in some cases, simply stop out of the workforce and take the opportunity to access federal financial aid. This became difficult because as more students returned, there was less funding available. But we'll talk a little bit more about completions and the efficiency of degree production in a few more slides.
Representative Wisnant.
Director Crane, are you going to talk more about the debt service later?
I can talk about the debt service, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Monroe, Representative Wisnant, during the Capital Construction Day.
Okay, that's all your follow-up. Madam Chair, thank you. That's all the debt service is affecting is capital construction.
I believe so.
You do not have, you're going to discuss pension obligation bonds?
Co-chairs, Representative Smith, Representative Wisnant, I had not planned to discuss that.
Mr. Madam Co-Chair, I'd like that to be discussed sometime during the presentation.
Okay. We'll check in with I'll talk to Doug and to the presenters and see when it would be most appropriate.
It's my understanding that community colleges have issued pension obligation bonds.
Okay. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I would at some point like to also see, and I appreciate this, that we're just talking about state appropriations, but it would be interesting to me to see those same trends, because I assume during those times, if the student population has gone up, tuitions and other fees substantially go up too. I'm not suggesting that offsets their cost differences, but it would be interesting to me to see, because some people pay for a course, some people pay for multiple courses, so it would be interesting to see how that compares to what happens on the other side, to see where what from my standpoint is a real true gap between what they're collecting and what it really costs to do it.
Co-chairs, Representative Lively, in a couple slides, we'll show the changing proportion of revenue sources over time with state tuition and local property taxes.
Thank you.
You've seen this slide before. This is a look at what state appropriations mean per student FTE. Again, you can see the dip during 10-11 and the years on both sides of that during the Great Recession. And the increase to what are approximately 1999-2000 levels in the last year. These are inflation adjusted, so that's important to note as well. This is the first of two slides that will look at community college revenue sources. And what you can see here is that we have state funding, property taxes, and tuition, and that the tuition sort of arcs up over time and particularly increases during the period where state funding declines, starting in 2009 and 2013-14. So you can see the switch there from majority state-funded to majority tuition-funded, and we're moving towards greater parity now as state funding increased this biennium, but it's still on the side of more tuition as opposed to more state funding. Presented proportionally, this is the same information, but makes a little clearer here how the proportions have shifted in state funding, property taxes, and tuition over time for community college funding.
Representative Wisnett.
Madam Chair, thank you. So this doesn't reflect local bonding in anything. That's strictly...
This is... Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, no, this is only local property taxes.
Because, follow-up? Thank you, Madam Chair. Because a lot of community college funding districts have approved a lot of bond measures. Are we going to see anything on that, a slide, or how that's a deport? You know, or because some community college districts have gone way out to help their community college on some bonding.
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, not today, but we can certainly add that into the discussion about pension obligation bonds that you'd like to have.
Thank you.
This is, man, I hit it again. This slide is different in my deck and shows Oregon Promise Awards as well.
Oh, here
in
we
a, go. There we go. You've also seen this slide before. This is a look at tuition and fees over time. These are, again, inflation adjusted, and how state aid has tracked tuition and fees over time as well. This provides a look at tuition fee variability across the 17 community colleges. The average statewide, this is for 15 credit hours, three terms, is 4,904, but it increases and decreases depending on the local district. And it's important to note that this is not a HEC decision. This is not something that they come to us for approval. It's a decision of the local governing board.
Yep.
And I alluded to this slide earlier. This is an attempt to track both funding and completions simultaneously. And what's interesting to you'll see a version of this for the universities as well next week. But what we can see here is that despite the shift in funding, where state funding went down, tuition fees went up, there's an increasing productivity and efficiency across the community colleges. So looking at the line, which is completions per 100 FTE, you can see that for every 100 FTE that are enrolled, more completions are happening each year. I think this is driven in significant part by the growth in certificate production in the community colleges, but it shows that despite cuts, they have been able to increase funding. I want to just caveat that this is sort of a preliminary analysis, and it raises a number of questions for us about what actually happened at the colleges to enable them to be more efficient, and how did they manage the cuts at the same time that they increase enrollment and increased completions per FTE. Just to touch briefly on the federal role that funding plays in Oregon's community college system, I think there are two important factors identified in these blocks. First is that total Pell Grant award in 15-16 to students at the 17 community colleges is nearly $175 million. So that is about 60% on an annual basis of the state investment, and is a significant amount of money that is flowing into the state. I know one of the ideas behind the Oregon Promise is to increase the amount of federal financial aid that comes into the state. We don't have data for this year on that available at this point, but we'll be looking closely at that to see if that has in fact happened. It's also worth noting, looking at the box on the right, that 61% of associate degree completers and 60% of certificate completers received a Pell Grant at least one term. So it is having a significant impact on the ability of Oregonians to complete their post-secondary educations.
May I ask about the Pell Grants? Is there Students redo their FAFSA every year, and you have to recertify your eligibility every year for the Pell Grant. So there's no guarantee. There's a guarantee for a year, but that's it. They have to reapply every year.
Representative Smith Mourner, Representative Monroe, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
It's important to note as well that I think there is opportunity to expand the number of students who are receiving Pell Grants in Oregon. This tracks the number of recipients and their percentage compared to the total enrollment in Oregon community colleges mm-hmm. over time. And you can see that between 20% and 15% of the total headcount, which is about 300,000, are receiving the Pell Grant. I think some of that has to do with the things that we discussed earlier around part-time enrollment, but some of it may have to do with lack of information, students being unaware that the Pell Grant is available to them. Parents or student not filing taxes, which is mandatory for eligibility, or they simply may not be degree seeking. Research from the Community College Research Center at Columbia University does note that the community college sector, when compared to public four-year institutions or private institutions, has the lowest percentage of students that are receiving the Pell Grant, despite having, in general, the highest need. So I think this is an opportunity for us to expand programs such as FAFSA Plus and make sure that students are aware of the money that's available to them.
Representative Lively.
So I understand. So the Pell Grant, so I appreciate that paperwork has to be filed and they qualified, but what's the requirement from it says here not degree seeking. So if they're not seeking a degree or certificate, then they're not eligible?
That is correct. Co-chairs, Representative Lively, they have to be declared degree seeking students. This slide is, again, an attempt to look at affordability in another way and to look at some of the challenges that students face when they only enroll in, six credits a term over time. The first line of this slide you saw earlier on the affordability day, tracking tuition and fees, books and supplies, room and board, personnel expenses, and I think it's important to note that room and board is the most expensive element of that. And I mean, to be fair, people have to pay room and board regardless of whether they're community college students or not. But what it does is drive up the overall cost over time. So, I mean, this could be the high cost of low enrollment to students because the total amount that they have to spend increases over time. And we also know from the literature that part-time students are less likely to complete degrees than full-time enrolled students.
Representative Wisnett.
Madam Chair, thank you. Committee members, we heard this in the policy committee. Does the HEC provide the community colleges any advice on dormitories? Do all community colleges have dormitories? Some do not, some do. Any recommendations or advice from the HEC on, you know, is this a good idea? Is it better left to the private market?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, I think a minority of community colleges have dormitories. I don't know the exact number. Three, Executive Director Cannon believes. We do not provide advice to them about whether they should build dormitories or not. It has not been something that we've addressed.
Just one quick follow-up. Do community colleges work with, if they're nearby a four-year university, and you know, are they available to use those dormitories or not from the four-year schools?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, I don't know the answer to that. We can certainly follow up.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
I'll speak to Southwestern. We don't have a really close university, so they don't share facilities much. But we do have a fair amount of housing at Southwestern, and it has helped that school maintain programs because they pay a different tuition rate, and it has been helpful for getting kids from all over the state and actually out of the state in our community. So it's worked for them.
This is a just another look at some of the state administered financial aid programs, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the Oregon Promise. These are just the two largest programs that the HEC helps oversee. And, you know, as discussed, these are strong tools for providing funding to help students pay for college and be successful in college. This slide talks a little bit about the Oregon Promise supports for the first year experience. $1.7 million were allocated in 2016 for distribution to community colleges as a way to help them retain Oregon Promise students and provide services for what they were anticipating would be an increase in the number of first-time and, in many cases, full-time students coming into their colleges. We have provided a preliminary report to the legislature that was submitted in December of 2016. A final report will be coming to the legislature in the end of April. And some of the ways that that funding has been used is to provide first-year experiences for students, student success teams built of faculty, administration, student support individuals, professional development for them so that they can better serve students. And, again, it's been used in a variety of ways across the institutions, and we'll be providing a more complete report about that to the legislature at the end of this month. We will now turn to a fairly technical discussion that I will try and summarize as best I can about the mechanics of the Oregon Community College Support Fund distribution that the HEC oversees. The ideas behind the distribution method are to provide stability, predictability, and sufficient resources for local community colleges to meet their educational needs. They're also designed to provide support in particular for small institutions that are not able to achieve the efficiencies of scale that larger institutions may be able to achieve. As I mentioned earlier, we do not provide funding for hobby and recreation courses, and that we do provide funding for other courses throughout the 17 institutions, especially career and technical education, adult basic skills, English as a second language, as well as remedial education.
So if we to clarify the post-secondary remedial, so the community colleges are eligible for state funding, but those courses are not available for, or those count towards or don't count towards their financial aid federally?
Representative Smith Warner, I believe that they do count towards their federal financial aid because they are credit bearing. They are credit bearing, but they do not count towards graduation requirements.
Thank you.
Getting a little more into the detail here, the Community College Support Fund distribution has three primary components. The first is categorical funding. This is what is taken off the top, and this is used to provide support for contracts out of district, the Department of Corrections, distributed learning or distance learning, as well as the Community College Strategic Fund. In 2015-17, on a Community College Support Fund of $550 million, this was $11.5 million. So this is set aside before the next components happen in the formula. So the second step in the formula is base funding. This is, again, where stability is prioritized and where smaller institutions receive a little extra weighting in their funding. This is calculated based on a dollar value. In 15-16, it was $819 for every FTE, up to 1,100. If an institution did not have 1,100 FTE, they received half of that amount for the FTE between their actual and between 1,100. This amount was then weighted based on institutional size, with higher weighting going to smaller institutions. Again, this is in recognition of the fact that there are certain fixed costs to run a college, and that small institutions are not able to realize efficiencies of scale or generate as much funding from students or tuitions as large institutions may be able to.
And if I can point out to either confirm or deny, this also means that Portland Community College, for example, is disadvantaged by this funding formula because of their high because of their high numbers. Is that accurate?
Representative Smith Warner, in terms of their base, I think the answer is yes. The base funding is has very little variance across the 17 institutions. I could provide a detailed breakout if that would be beneficial. The next component, which is by far the largest component, is tied more directly, very directly, to FTE. So that is where institutional size becomes a more relevant factor. Mm-hmm. But you're right. For base funding, the amount that Tillamook Bay receives is not wildly different from the amount that Portland Community College receives.
Okay. And is there a cap on that distribution formula? So you get it per student up to a certain amount and then...
Yes, and that is set by a number of different factors. There's a three-year rolling average for the number of students that are enrolled across the system that determines the number of fundable FTE that each institution receives. The value of a FTE, again, it's set at $819 in 2015-16. By statute, cannot decrease more than 5%, and should increase at the Portland's CPI each year. The HEC has an opportunity to set the what's called the biennial growth management component. So we have a policy lever where we can increase the value of an FTE or, and if we do that, decrease the number of FTE that receive funding, or do the opposite. So during the Great Recession, for example, community colleges were enrolling students that they were not receiving state funding for because they had hit their cap of fundable FTE.
Okay. Representative Wisdom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your question about that. But I've tried to study the PK-12 formula, and I always get the response that any changes to it creates winners and losers. In the community college distribution formula, the thing that doesn't get put in the formula is local option bonding and pays. And the Central Oregon Community College went through a period where we were getting we were getting very little state funding because of what they're looking at. So I think it needs to be looked at. It's different than the PK-12, but again, you have to look at how the local community, you know, they're paying their taxes on these local option things to bring in programs or buildings or whatever. So it's not because of the presentation, but I still understand it all. It's difficult and all the factors, but there's winners and losers that come from it.
Good point.
Co-chair.
Mr. Co-chair.
It doesn't take into consideration cost of living differences across the state either, which are pretty dramatic, really. And again, PCC, because it's where the cost of living is highest, would be disadvantaged by that, while they're advantaged by the scope of size. They're disadvantaged by the cost of living being higher in the Portland area.
Indeed.
Just to touch briefly on the third component of the distribution formula, and the next slide will illustrate the proportions here. But this is calculated based on total public resources. So we look at local property taxes as well as state funding to provide an equitable level of funding for each institution. And again, as I mentioned, it's connected to a three-year weighted average of fundable FTE in order to provide stability. The situation that I think this formula is trying to avoid is if there's a huge spike in enrollment in one part of the state, because the total amount of funding is fixed, that would take funding away from the other community colleges. So by using a three-year average and by having a cap on the fundable FTE, it's an attempt to provide stability and predictability over time.
Senator Roblin?
It's also kind of the equalization formula because it does take your local property taxes, and some people have a bigger base for property taxes, others have smaller, so the amount of general fund that goes to each of them is dependent on the interaction between those, as I understand it.
Co-chair Senator Roblin, that is correct. When the when we look at the amount of local property taxes, we essentially fill in state funding on top so that everybody ends up at the same place. But that does mean that the amount of state funding received by institutions does vary. This slide here looks at the proportions. So, you know, as I mentioned, the categorical funding, 2%, the base, which is roughly equal for every institution, is about 5%. And then the distribution formula, which is based on FTE, is the vast majority, 93% of the formula. We're down to three more slides, two of which have content. And this slide and the next slide are an attempt to answer the question of what do colleges spend their money on. And it's important to note that this is not something that the HEC has authority over. This is something that local governing boards have authority over. But the question has come up in this committee and other committees about how they spend their money. And it's personnel is the biggest driving factor for institutional costs. And if you look here at this slide, you can see that compensation benefits is nearly two-thirds of the funding. Service and supplies is the next largest category. This includes utilities, telecommunications, phone and internet, advertising, supplies, minor equipment, as well as professional and contracted services. So if a college needs to contract out with an organization to provide student coaching or grant writing, this would also be included within this. Capital outlay is just 7.5%, and this is land, new buildings, building maintenance, libraries, and computer hardware. And then the other expenses is just 2.1%.
Senator Thompson.
Would the 2.1% be debt retirement?
I, co-chairs, Senator Thompson, I don't know the answer to that. When I looked through the definitions, other expenses was defined as whatever wasn't captured in the other larger categories.
Pretty broad. So,
but I can take a closer look.
Okay. Follow up, Senator Thompson.
Thank you. And the compensation benefits, how much of that, if you don't have the figures, you can give them to me later, or it would be due to PERS costs?
In co-chairs, Senator Thompson, in this year, which is 2014-15, the total PERS costs were $72,161,895.
Well, do you have a percentage to the 65? What percent of that is, of the 65 is that, please?
Maybe you could submit a more comprehensive.
Yes. Co-Chair, Senator Thompson, I can provide a breakdown of that. I don't have the percentages calculated now.
That way I go on record saying I actually asked a question.
Right. Really impressed. Senator Robin.
Go back to the previous slide. I just wanted to ask one question if you do it. Because those other two little distributions are very small, the in K-12 we find some schools get astronomical cost per student numbers. I mean, real astronomical. We had it here, had that conversation. Because that's so small, I would expect that the actual cost per student that each community college gets are very close to each other. So that there doesn't seem to be the same discrepancy. So is it possible to get that number, what each community college actually gets to spend on each student, so that we can see the disparity between the two? Because I think in a question that our co-chair asked earlier, she was trying to get at that. Does PCC get more or less money per kid than others? And I think there should be a way to get that number for each community college. And that would be helpful, I think. That makes sense.
Co-chair, Senator Roblin, we can provide that.
Okay, thanks.
Did you have?
No, ma'am.
Go ahead.
The senator took mine.
We're asking your question for you.
This is a look at expenditure by function, and this data comes from the Community College Financial Information System. So we receive reports annually, and I think much of this information is publicly available on our website. And What you can see here is that instruction is far and away the largest category, taking nearly 50% of the expenditures at the colleges, followed by student services, going through this clockwise. Instruction is 48%. Instructional support, this would be administration, libraries, course and curriculum development, educational media, is 10%. Student services, this could be the admissions office, the registrar, activities related to students' physical, intellectual, cultural development and well-being, student newspapers, intercollegiate athletics, career guidance, student aid, that makes up 12%. College support, administration, governing board, communications, this takes up, as well as the fiscal operations, this takes up 20%, and then the plant operation and maintenance is the final 10%.
Senator Roblin.
So this does not include, like, student fees. So if they have a government fee that would go into, say, the college support that the students pay separately, would that be part of that, or is that a separate amount because it's not necessarily general fund? It would might be a general fund expenditure. Where do those kinds of fees go? Does it show up here?
Co-chair, Senator Roblin, I can confirm this for you, but my understanding is that this looks at all of the the revenue and just how it's expended and broken out by different categories.
Okay.
The final slide for today, I think you've seen versions of this before, but this is the state support for public community colleges. You can see that the governor's request budget puts funding for community colleges at $555.3 million, $550 million for the community college support fund, and then additional $5.3 million to continue targeted programs for student success. These include the $1.7 million for the Oregon Promise First Year Experience support, student success grants totaling $3 million, which were funded initially out of House Bill 3063 from 2015. This also provides funding for the Sabin Schellenberg Center in Milwaukee, Oregon, as well as the Margaret Carter Skills Center. With that, any questions that you may have?
Colleagues? Okay. So this is a good breaking point. You don't think you need to get a little advance on tomorrow? We do actually have, the co-chairs have a meeting at 9:45 with the big chair, so this is fine. But
co-chairs, tomorrow we'll start with the Oregon Community College Association.
Gotcha.
And so it would be best to wait until then if possible.
Great. Okay. Any further questions, colleagues? Okay. With that, thank you both very much. Mostly thank you, Patrick. I'd like to close today's hearing on Senate Bill 5524. And with that, the meeting is adjourned. And we'll see you all back here tomorrow. And with that, the meeting is adjourned, and we'll see you all back here tomorrow.